All right, here we go. So last week I told you about the dangerous aspects of this sutra, in that without any wisdom whatsoever, we would take these teachings and go haywire and cause all kinds of harm to ourselves and others, thinking that we can do whatever we want. Very nihilistic idea that none of it matters, so we can just do whatever. That's nihilism. Buddhist is that's an extreme. You can't do that. The same time, to take this as a law and focus on the oneness of everything and reaffirm that there's just one is also what we would call an eternalist view, eternalism. And the Buddha says that's terrible. That's also an extreme, and you can't do that. Now, this is where it's going to, again, get difficult, because when we look at the Buddha's first roughly 20 years of teaching, he's primarily teaching discipline because he's creating a religion. I mean, he doesn't necessarily believe that it's a separate religion than Hinduism, but he's creating his own school, his own lineage. And anyone that creates a lineage has got to lay down the framework that makes theirs worth existing. Otherwise, how's it a new lineage? It's just you're following everybody else. And so he wasn't trying to do that. But the one thing that was behind the structure of his discipline was this whole new sense of morals. Because, I don't really know this, except for gleaning it from the sutras, that apparently in his day there wasn't very much moral system. Well, okay, we can say that today. I think you can say it in any day. We tend to have a slightly ridiculous idea that India in the Buddha's day was just this really holy place, and apparently not. Just like it is today, it's not. I mean, sure, there's Hindus everywhere, but you can say the same thing about the United States and Christians. Doesn't make us a moral country, but if you were to look at us from the outside, oh, all these people go to church, they do all these, they have all these hellish celebrations, but that does not make us good people. And India is the same thing. I mean, they have all of their horrific problems, and a lot of them. I mean, they're just as corrupt in their own way. Not to take away from those that are legitimately spiritual people, but the same thing here. We have legitimately spiritual people here. You can even find some of them in the Buddhist communities in the U.S. But Buddha's main approach to creating this discipline was to try to train people to get control of their five senses. And in general, this is what causes us to do all kinds of crazy things to begin with, because we want to feel good. We want to abandon or be separate from suffering. And so the way that we do that is to engage in pleasure. But the only way we know to engage pleasure is through five senses. To do something to cause us to feel pleasure from the outer sense data. That could be going to music performances of whatever you like, theater, movie, art, food, sex, drugs, you name it. It's something that we go out and find this outer thing, and draw it into our senses. So this is what I was saying is, we have a real problem with this. And so monastics were heavily, heavily controlled. And when I say controlled, I'm serious. They were heavily controlled. He ruled them with an iron fist. And the minute they did something that he didn't like, he made a new rule about it. So for 20 years, the Buddha's constantly making a new rule. So some of them, they would eat their food after begging, and then they would save some of it. And then throughout the morning, they would be eating. And the Buddha went, "That looks terrible. Because you're like sitting around, you've eaten, and then you like, I don't know, whatever it is that they would do, wash a robe or something. Then they'd sit down and they'd start eating. He's like, "This looks horrible. This just looks bad." So there's a new rule. You get to eat at one time, and you have to eat everything you have, and that's it. So the one meal rule came about. Buddha did things just because he didn't like the look of it, too. Wasn't always just, "This is going to be, you know, a discipline because we need to have a higher conscience." Sometimes he's like, "This just looks terrible. You're not going to do that." If they had nice robes, nope, no nice robes. That just looks terrible. You look just like the high priest running around, and this is awful. From now on, you can only wear rags that you find from the trash, and you have to dye them this color. That's it. You know, being a beggar on a street corner with a nice printed sign instead of a piece of cardboard. You know, you go and you get Kinko's to print you up a really nice poster board, you know, and you got your suit and your tie on and your nice felt fedora, and you're out there and you're going, "Yeah, I need money." And then you hold out your bowl.
Golden bowl.
But yeah, a golden bowl. I was going to say, you know, you have like a what is it called? A Waterford crystal bowl. Right? It just looks ridiculous. And the Buddha's like, "All right, that just looks horrible. You can't do that." So he creates all of these rules. And he keeps creating them. And it's funny because when you look at some of the sutras, and you have to get into the big ones. When you get into those big, long discourses, the ones that usually put you to sleep because you're just like reading 1,000 names, or you're reading so-and-so went to this place and then traveled. You know, it's just these long, grueling things, but you'll see conflicts that happen. Two monks start arguing about something. "Oh, he's, doing this thing." And then the monk says, "Well, yeah, but you're doing that thing. And this thing is better than yours." So the Buddha would come along and they would come and they would complain. "Hey, this guy ties his robe like this." And the other guy says, "Yeah, but look how he wears his. That, you know," and then they fight about it. And the Buddha says, "All right, that's it. From now on, you can't tie it either your way or your way. You're going to do it like this." And then there's a new rule. So the Buddha was also a judge, running around judging all of these problems that were happening within his community and creating more and more rules. That's why it took so long, and that's why we have so many rules. 270 for the monk. If you're a fully ordained monk, you have 270 rules you have to follow. That's extreme. That is a lot. Okay. Wanted to clarify how the law gets built on one hand. On the other hand, and for the more lofty stuff, the Buddha directly tells them and creates rules that deny them a whole lot of pleasures. Obviously, right away, he says, there's absolutely no more money. Well, I don't know if you know this or not. If you ever have any money at all, you know that it can bring you a lot of pleasure. There's a lot of cool stuff that you can do with it. So he takes that away from them. So now they got to find pleasure somehow without money. So the next thing he says is no beds. and no chairs. So now they're not allowed to sit on a chair. They always have to sit on the floor. And they're not allowed to sleep in a bed. They have to also sleep on the floor. And even, and this is true for at least all the monastics that I know, is even when you go to like the Chan Monastery, you know, in Thailand, when you go there, it's easy to see how the monks act because it's all quite out in the open. And you see them, they just lay on the floor. Wood floors, dirt floors, they just lay on the ground. Well, in China, they're a little more sophisticated than that. They don't just lay all over the ground. It looks like they have a bed. But when you pull the sheets and covers back, it's actually a wooden box. That's about the size of a twin bed. So you get to lay on a, basically, a raised up wooden box. And yes, it is uncomfortable as hell for the first, I don't know, 8 months maybe. You know, I used to wake up with my hip bones bruised and my shoulders bruised because it's, you know, you just get sore laying on the hard wooden floor. But then after that, it took me a long time to be able to, when I left, to sleep in a bed. I couldn't stand it. I always liked sleeping on the floor. So I owned a bed for a while and slept on the floor. So he takes away those kind of luxuries. He takes away sex. He takes away alcohol. He takes away, you know, all these different things that they enjoy. He takes away music. He takes away theater. He takes away art. All of it. You guys in St. Louis with your free art museums, those are out if you're a monastic. You can't go. So he creates all of these kinds of rules in order to overcome our desire for pleasure through the senses. And here's why. That pleasure through the senses causes us to have, in just very raw terms, lust over whatever it might be. Whatever your favorite thing is, you lust after that thing. And the Buddha says this is a very serious problem because while you are under the sway of that, you can't control anything. Your mind's consumed about thinking about it, thinking how you're going to get it, thinking how you're going to keep it once you have it, and blah, 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 blah. Anybody that has a pleasure that they like to indulge in, you know that that's what happens. We even joke about it. It's ridiculous how we do that. But, you know, we got all kinds of crazy little things here in the West, the little sayings that reflect how these desires control us. I'm sure none of you know this one, but, you know, in the 60s and 70s, they came up with one that was called 420. You guys probably don't know what that is because you've never experienced in that realm, I'm sure. But if you do know what it is, you see the ridiculousness of this. Or the response to whenever anybody comes up to you and says, hi. And then we would say some stupid thing like, well, not yet. Right? I mean, just, you know, these dumb little jokes. But all of this is focused on this desire to have this kind of pleasure through a certain sense organ. So Buddha shut all those down. After we finish with all of these hinayana trainings, after we have learned great discipline, and he weans us off of that and into the heavier foods of the Mahayana, of the Bodhisattvayana, here's what happens. He says, if you are wanting to actually perceive the true nature of mind, then you no longer reject the five senses. Here, Venerable Tseng Song says, if you wish to move in this one way, this universal scope of mind, you are not to dislike even the world of senses and ideas. Because the Buddha also used to say, don't dwell on Lakshana, don't dwell on these small d dharmas, don't sit there and, you know, entertain these thoughts. Always keep the mind focused, blah, blah, blah. So he's saying here, you don't have to do that anymore. He says, if you stop rejecting these things and you begin to accept them the exact same way that you accept when you go outside that there is the sun and a breeze and the sound of birds and all of these things that you normally do not pay any attention to whatsoever, but you just accept them as being a part of your environment. Like if you're in a nice park on a stroll. If we were to accept the activities of the sense organs, of the sense consciousnesses, of the thoughts that are in the mind, if we accept all of those the same way we accept the sound of the birds and the sunlight and the breeze and all of that while we're walking through a park as just being part of the environment, then we are behaving in a way that is the equivalent to enlightenment. This is how I know that the Buddha did not have some kind of mechanical mind, that he was separate from humans. He had all the exact... I mean, he is a human. That's the whole point. And so when all of his desires and lusts and everything else that comes up... Because, by the way, you got to remember, you cannot forget... That guy was a filthy rich prince who probably entertained himself in every way possible as a prince. You know, if he wanted a night with the ladies and drunken debauchery, I'm sure he had all the strippers he wanted. I'm sure he had all the money that, you know, he wanted to throw lavish parties or whatever it was. This guy did it. We know that to be true. He wasn't some kind of walking around Puritan before his enlightenment. He was carefree. An excellent student, incredibly intelligent person, but also a pretty wild guy. And he didn't know what the rest of the world looked like. He just thought it always looked like this. Well, doesn't everyone take out their 125-foot yacht when they want to, you know, go out and cruise the water? He doesn't know any better. So don't forget that he has all of these experiences prior to the path that he chooses. So with his enlightenment, he says, you don't suppress all of that stuff. You don't have to walk around going, oh, I can't have that kind of thought. Why would I think that? I must be terrible. All of that stuff, he says, that's out. It's all just, you don't do that. There's zero judging. So if, for some reason... you just happen to be walking and you have one of those flashbacks. Oh yeah, that one time where I was so high as a kite. So what? You don't say, oh, that's evil thought, I can't think about that. You just treat it as if it's a stiff breeze that just happened to hit you in that moment. While you're out on this walk in the park. Or maybe it's the stark sound of a crow nearby. caws at you, and then you, oh, yeah, okay, there's a crow. And you just take notice of him, but that's it. You don't throw a rock at him and try and get it to go away. I mean, if you do, you have some problems. But that's generally, that's not what we do. Look what it says. The wise one, the person that has some wisdom, strives to know goal. What that means is they don't have the goal of having a Puritan mind. They don't have the goal of being enlightened. They don't have the goal. Notice, there is no goal. They're not trying to attain anything. They're not trying to become anything. They're certainly not interested with fixing their character flaws. I mean, a lot of us turn to Buddhism and we think that it's going to be some kind of Buddhist psychotherapy that's going to help us fix our character flaw. Whatever that might be. But a person with great wisdom does not approach it that way. They have no interest in that. What does it say next? The foolish one takes on all kinds of crazy things. They fetter themselves down. They put so much weight on themselves. Fettering, you know, is like a putting on the chains and shackles. So their idea is, oh yeah, no, I shouldn't have those. Let's put that chain on. So I don't have that thought. Oh, and let's put one around my neck so that I don't go to a movie. Oh, let's do this one too. Oh, and I gotta be vegetarian, so I gotta put this one on. Oh, I gotta be this. And they just like load themselves with all these stupid ideas that they think somehow are going to lead them to enlightenment. And yet each one they put on, they have some kind of goal. There's something in their mind that they are attached to. I guess in keeping with being a blasphemous Dharma teacher, one of the other things that I really don't like is within Buddhism, and don't get me wrong here with what I'm going to say, but I do find this problematic. There's way too much emphasis on environmentalism, but in the wrong way from Buddhism. In a completely wrong way. So you have Dharma teachers, these quote-unquote great teachers that hold these real lofty seats and big crowns and all this crap. And they say, oh, well, you know, blah, blah, blah about the environment. And then all the practitioners immediately run out and do something like, okay, well, I got to get rid of my car now and only have electric car because, wow, so-and-so said that it's best for environment. But you see what happens? They just fettered themselves. They just created a goal to take on this thing to achieve something. That's not how that's supposed to work. In fact, the whole concept of environmentalism from a Buddhist perspective is supposed to arise from only two places. One, the result of your Lojong through Tonglen. You hear that? Through your practice of Tonglen, a very organic form of environmentalism should arise within the practitioner. That's in the Lojong. The second one comes from the path of Bodhisattvayana in general, specifically within the yogic community, which is the practice of land, healing, and pacification. Land healing and pacification. Land healing and pacification is not about reversing global warming that humans have created. No, not at all. Not at all. In fact, it has to do with realigning the elements and the elemental energies and the quote-unquote entities that live within that environment. Now, that's the truth. So all this other stuff you hear is kind of, according to this text, foolishness. Foolishness. But we do this with all kinds of things that we take on. You see why this text is so dangerous? This is not giving you a license to go out and do whatever you want because you're going to act like you're enlightened. That's not what this means. Because remember, you're only supposed to take this on after you have attained the fruit of being disciplined according to the Hinayana. So, if you want to, raise your hand or shoot me an email that states that you feel you are completely qualified now to work within this level and that you have attained the fruit of all the Hinayana discipline, then let me know that. So when I see you acting crazy, I know that you are practicing what we call crazy wisdom, which is a real thing. If you've been in the Lojong, you know that that's a real term. And then I won't say anything to you. So if you go and you burn down somebody's house, I'll just be like, oh, wow, that's an interesting display of crazy wisdom. Someday I'll get there and I'll understand what you're doing, but I'm not going to say anything about it. But if you don't let me know that you've attained these fruits and you go burn down your neighbor's house, I'm going to go, what are you doing? This is totally contrary to your training. So please, let me know beforehand that you've completed your Hinayana training and now you're going to attempt the crazy wisdom practices. Just so that I don't freak out from stress. Look what he says. There's one Dharma, not many. Distinctions arise from the clinging needs of the arrogant. And to seek the mind with the mind is the greatest of all mistakes. One Dharma means, when you look at Buddhism, when you take a step back and you look at all of the factions, all the lineages, all of this and all of that, and the different approaches, all of those distinctions are not real. I mean, not really. Because the base, bottom line for any organization in the Buddhism and any teacher has to be exactly the same thing. There is only one Dharma. That is the three turnings and three trainings. If you don't know those, you can go back to your Lojong text and take a look at it, because I think it's all explained to you in the very beginning. Just so that you can go over it and they remind you, now that you're in this Bodhisattva training, here's a reminder of what is really happening here. Right? Three turnings, three trainings. I think that's even a slogan in there. When we begin to make these kinds of distinctions, then we realize that those distinctions and discriminations arise only because we have stupidity. And that stupidity causes us to create these kinds of things. It's not wise. Rest and unrest derive from passion. And I looked up derive in the dictionary to see what that term really means. And it also points to an organic process. It means something that springs up from the influence of something else. So if we are able to rest our minds, or if our minds are completely out of control, those states have arisen due to the influence of, in this case, passion. Passion is going back to that fettering. So what he means in here is if your mind is crazy and not and has no rest, it's not calm, it's not trained, we generally think, oh, well, that's what the mundane is like. Those are all the non-Buddhists out there. What I used to be, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's true. And that kind of mind arises out of the passions of running around being crazy. But we can be Buddhist and still insanely foolish. I mean, a lot of you, as I look, you've known me long enough to realize that's totally true. Because I mirror that all the time. You can be completely foolish while you are still Buddhist. And look, you can apparently get fancy robes and crazy hats and still be a complete fool. The reason why is because the rest, which is artificial, by the way, arises out of the now foolish passion of the goal that I'm going to be something. I'm going to be Buddhist. I'm going to be Bodhisattva. I'm going to be a yogin. I'm going to be a monk. I'm going to be whatever you want to call yourself. Householder, a Manjushri, whatever. And when you have a goal, you get the same thing. So the rest and unrest, which will happen even in that Buddhist mind, even if you have those goals, your mind will be unrested when you're trying to attain them. When you think you've attained the goal, you may have some rest, but it's all artificial. And it's all arising from this grasping and clinging need. But look what the next line is. With enlightenment, there's no liking or disliking. All duality comes from the ignorant inference. So, we have altruistic wishes. I mean, that's part of Bodhisattvayana, right? We have these great wishes that may I become enlightened so that I may lead all others to that. Or we say, may all beings share in this merit. May all beings have, may I, you know, be of benefit to other beings. And so we have all of these kinds of wishes, which we could say were goals. But when we're talking about from the level of enlightenment, we have to realize that those goals are only relative. That's it. Because from an enlightened point of view, you have never attained the goal, and you have never not attained the goal. I know that gets complicated again, but that's the reality. He says, dualities, the idea of judging something to be right or wrong, good or evil, positive or negative, wholesome or unwholesome, are exactly like dreams or flowers in the air when you've dropped acid. Literally. I don't want a show of hands, but any of you that have messed with any kind of what is the word?
Psychedelics.
And you get those What the hell is that?
Hallucinations?
Hallucinations. Jeez, all of a sudden I don't even know English. You take a psychedelic, you have a hallucination. Those hallucinations are as real as your judging something to be wholesome or unwholesome, healthy or unhealthy, peaceful or not peaceful, good or evil. I mean, is any of this scaring anyone? Your hallucination is the exact equal to those. Gain and loss, right and wrong, such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. That means immediately. He's not talking about you slowly wean yourself off of judging whether you have a gain or a loss. He doesn't mean that you should take your time and go through a subtle therapy to slowly come off of judging something to be right and wrong, good and evil, wholesome or unwholesome, healthy or unhealthy, good for the environment or bad for the environment, blah, blah, blah. You don't do it in a slow, kind of gradual way. You do it immediate. And abolish means a complete throwing into the trash. Like a casting out. Gone. You take a dirty pair of pants, right? They have mud all over them because you've been working in your garden. You put them in the laundry machine. The washer spins it around, and when they come out, they're clean, right? That's not an abolishment because it still took too long. An abolishment is you hold up the dirty pants and you say, "Begone!" And all the dirt vanishes instantaneously. That's abolishment. It would look like you take your dirty clothes and you take your mala and you say, "The power of Buddha compels you." And then dirt vanishes. And now it's as clean as it's been dry clean. Look at how nice this looks. Can you see it? It's very good. Nice, beautiful, dark blue wool. Good shawl. Nice and clean because the power of Buddha commands you. And dirt's gone. It didn't even fall off. It just disappeared. That's what he says. Abolished at once. So what do we do with that? Here's how you approach this. Now we're going to get pragmatic. We got to give you something to work with. Otherwise, you're just going to go out and be crazy. We don't need more crazy people in the world. That's not helpful. Until you have the direct immediate experience, i.e. you have the self-realization that all of your judging wears you out, makes you an annoying person, it annoys yourself, it's exhausting, you see how it wears on other people. Until you have that direct immediate experience. Until you have the direct immediate experience of, wow, yeah, all the stuff that I believed when I was 5 that I don't believe now just vanished. It's nowhere to be found. So everything that I'm thinking and believing is exactly like a hallucination and has no more substance than that. Until you have those direct immediate experiences, you say, for the purpose of training my mind and training it, let's expand this, because you've all heard that. For the purpose of training, I take on the vow of, right? You've heard that, but let's dig into this just a tiny bit. For the purpose of training my mind to be able to perceive through the camouflage and deception of ignorance, so that I may directly perceive the truth of and have the realization of this aspect, whatever that might be, of seeing shunyata, of seeing the oneness of all things, of seeing duality, the nature of duality. You plug in whatever that is. You say, I take on the training of restricting myself of any use of drugs, any use of chocolate protein powder, any use of sexual misconduct, any use of drinking alcohol, lying to my coworkers, whatever. But you see what happens. Your hinayana practices, which are not to abandon, Buddha says that. Even when you become enlightened, you have to maintain all those vows that you've taken. You need to recognize that you are taking those vows in order to see through your own delusion. In order to recognize the true nature of these things. Of your judging, of your beliefs, of all of this. Now, if you have that realization, then your work in environmentalism, perfect. Your work in assisting others, perfect. Your work in preaching Dharma, perfect. I hope I did this part of the text justice. I hope I did it right. But I'm trying to give you a pragmatic scope of this. And I cut our offerings and everything very short because I knew this was going to be a long talk. But to give you this information without sending you into long retreats, I don't know how else to do it other than try to bring out those bullet points in the most pragmatic way. Because the way I got this information was months in a monastery, in a temple. Hours and hours at a time, which I don't think you have those luxuries. So we're going to, of course, we always have to do a mantra practice, so I want us to do the, we're not going to do transforming of mind. I want us to just recite 100 Wandamala of the six-syllable mantra, and as soon as we're done, to just go into a meeting.